Open up to John 12. We'll continue our series there by beginning in John 12, verse 12. And so in just a few minutes, we'll read that. You can turn there now, though, John 12, starting in verse 12. This will be a passage that is often familiar when we approach Easter. On Palm Sunday, the week before Easter, this might be a passage we go to because of the triumphal entry. And so we'll look at that passage and then some of the context around it. But I want to start by describing a very different triumphal entry, if you will. And it's one that took place in 1977 in the capital city of what was then called the Central African Empire. It's a landlocked country right in Central Africa. There was a lavish coronation ceremony for the self-proclaimed Imperial Majesty, Bokassa I. Kent Hughes, in his commentary on John, he describes this in some detail, and I'll read it for you. He'd already been a dictator at that point, but he wanted to declare himself more than a dictator, but an imperial emperor. And so he planned this elaborate ceremony. The price tag for that one event that was designed and choreographed by a French designer, the price tag for that event was $25 million, which is a lot of money, but to put it in context, that was a third of the annual budget of the entire country. So they took a third of the entire budget and he spent it on this coronation ceremony. Here's how it played out. At 10:10, exactly that morning, there was a blare of trumpets and the roll of drums that announced the approach of His Majesty. The procession began with eight of Bokassa's 29 official children. They were parading down the royal carpet to their seats. That followed by Jean Bedel Bokassa II, who would be the heir to the throne. He was seated on a red pillow to the left of the throne. Catherine followed, the favorite of Bokassa's nine wives. If you wondered how he had 29 children, it's because he had nine wives also. But this was his favorite, so she got to sit next to him on the throne. She was wearing a $73,000 gown strewn with pearls that she had picked out herself. The emperor arrived in a gold eagle-bedecked imperial coach drawn by six matching horses. He wore a 32-pound robe decorated with 785,000 pearls. On his brow, he wore a golden crown of laurel wreaths. As this sacred march came to a conclusion, he seated himself in a throne that was designed to look like an eagle, and the throne itself cost $2.5 million. Let me show you a picture of this throne. This is his big eagle throne that he sat on as he entered in. And so, yeah, he sits on this. He replaces the gold laurel wreath with a $2.5 million crown that had an 80-carat diamond on it. Another picture of this ceremony. This is him sitting with his favored wife here on the throne. Bokassa's reign was not as imposing as his coronation. He only reigned as imperial emperor for about 2 years. He left the country on a trip, and while he was away, the French organized a coup to replace him. And the people apparently were very glad because he was known as a somewhat brutal dictator. There was mass starvation in the country because of how he had mismanaged things. One of the things he did that was particularly unpopular is he required all of the school children from elementary age up through college to wear a particular school uniform that was only produced by a company owned by his wife. And so there was just corruption upon corruption that was self-serving. And so he was removed and the people were glad for that. That ceremony, though, and his reign, I think typifies why many people are opposed to monarchies today. Because that's what they picture. They picture lavish, unnecessary spending and self-serving reigns designed to just improve the wealth of the individual. What we'll see in this passage is that Jesus is a very different kind of king with a very different kind of reign. We'll see that he enters into Jerusalem not to sit on a lavish gold throne, but he enters in riding on a donkey. And he declared that his hour had come, not for a violent overthrow of Rome, not for a way to just gather wealth to himself, but the hour had come for his sacrificial death, that as king, he would lay himself down as a sacrifice. He's a different kind of king with a different kind of rain, then it calls us to a different type of living that follows our great King. Let's read this now. John 12, starting in verse 12. And as I read this, I want you to think about this example I gave of Bokassa the First and how different, even just reading this, how different Jesus' kingship is than that. John 12, starting in verse 12. On the next day, the large crowd who had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took the branches of the palm trees and went out to meet him and began to shout, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." Jesus, finding a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." These things his disciples did not understand at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things to him. So the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to testify about him. For this reason also the people went and met him, because they heard that he had performed this sign. So the Pharisees said to one another, "You see that you are not doing any good. Look, the world has gone after him." Now, there were some Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These then came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip came and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip came and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it. He who hates his life in this world will keep it to life eternal. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came out of heaven, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." So the crowd of people who stood by and heard it were saying it had thundered. Others were saying, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered and said, "This voice has not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." He was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. The crowd then answered him, "We have heard out of the law that the Christ is to remain forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" So Jesus said to them, "For a little while longer the light is among you. Walk while you have the light, so that the darkness will not overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he goes. While you have the light, believe in the light, so that you may become the sons of light." These things Jesus spoke, and he went away and hid himself from them. Okay, so we'll look at this in really two parts, these two main scenes. First, we'll see that the king has come in humility, and then we'll see that the hour has come for self-sacrifice. And so let's look at this first part, this king coming in humility. I'll give a little bit less attention to this part because J.O. just preached on the triumphal entry of Christ about a month ago, the week before Easter, out of a different passage, but really same themes. And so I'll give a little bit less time there. Notice it says this is the next day. To remind you, it's the day obviously following what had just taken place earlier in John 12, which was this meal in Bethany, which is right outside of Jerusalem, where Jesus sat and he ate with Mary and Martha, Lazarus, who he'd just raised from the dead. This whole scene unfolds there. That was likely like the night of the Sabbath day, so after the sun went down. It's now the next day. It's Sunday. And there's a large crowd, it says, has come to the feast. This feast coming up is Passover. And when it says a large crowd, it was large. Josephus, who was an ancient Jewish historian about this time a little bit later, he estimated as many as 2.5 million people came to Jerusalem for the Passover, which that was just packed. Every street, every corner would have been full. I often think of the closest we can, I think, remember here is when we had the total eclipse. What was it like, 8 years ago? And do you guys remember how crowded it was? Like people came from all over, and if you tried to drive up north, like to Ottawa Falls or beyond, to go to the eclipse, and then tried to come back, Like, how many of you did that? Do you remember what the freeways were like? I mean, everything was full. We tried to exit the freeway. Everybody else tried to exit the freeway. All the back roads were full. The side roads, off the side roads, were full. There were just people everywhere. It was like super stressful. I didn't like it. That is what Jerusalem was like at the time of the Passover year. The Jews who'd spread out, they came back for the Passover. And so there's a large crowd, which factors in as we go along, but just picture that. Large crowd teeming with people. They were laying out these palm branches. Palm branches had become really part of the national symbol of Israel at this time. They associated with the people. And so they're laying out these palm branches and crying out with these loud voices, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." It's quoting from Psalm 118, Psalm 118, verse 26. To come in the name of the Lord is to, in some sense, come representing him, representing the Lord, to come to set forth his purposes. They identify him as the King of Israel. They say, "Hosanna," which roughly translated means something like, "May God save us." He comes riding on a donkey. And we might wonder, why does he do that? Why does he ride a donkey? He's been walking for this whole 3.5 years, or 3 years of ministry, all up and down, north and south in Israel. We're not told other times that he's riding a donkey. So why does he hear? It's because he's very intentionally fulfilling a prophecy from the book of Zechariah. Zechariah is an Old Testament book. It was written about 500 years before this. It's a short book, but it's quoted more than 80 times in the New Testament because it focuses so much prophetically on the first and second coming of Christ. And in Zechariah, we have this prophecy in Zechariah chapter 9, starting in verse 9. And you'll see in here the point that they quote. Zechariah 9, starting in verse 9, says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem." Parallelism there to talk about the people of Israel, people in Jerusalem. "Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey." It goes on, "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. The bow of war will be cut off. He will speak peace to the nations. His dominion will be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." So this predictive passage in Zechariah, it promised a king who would come, and he would be humble, and he would be gentle, and he would even be riding it on a donkey, not a conquering war horse, and yet he would bring peace. And it's a peace that would go from sea to sea. And they were to rejoice. And so that's what they're doing. They're fulfilling this. They're rejoicing over this. They're saying, this is the king. This is the king who comes. This is the king who will bring salvation. He's humble and gentle, not because he lacks power and authority, but because he's using that power and authority to serve and to save. On the other hand, riding a donkey is still a kingly act. Even in the ancient Near East there, that kings would at times ride donkeys. And so that in itself was not that strange for a king, although a conquering king would be seen to ride a big war horse, a stallion. But it fits within really what we're going to see about this king as it goes on. It's a king who comes to die, not a king who comes to conquer. The disciples, it said, didn't understand this at the time, but it was later. You can picture them later reminiscing and realizing what we experienced. It was fulfilling Zechariah 9. But I want you to notice here that the Pharisees see this, and their fears are starting to come true. Look at verses 18 and 19. Verses 18 and 19, we see the crowds are there. And then verse 19, it says, "The Pharisees said to one another, 'You see that you're not doing any good. Look, the world has gone after him.'" If you were here with us last week, we would have seen that near the end of John 11, this is what they're afraid of. They're seeing all these people start to follow him. And in fact, if you flip back to John 11, verse 47, you see where they talk about this. The Pharisees, these Jewish religious leaders, they gather in this council called the Sanhedrin. And they say in verse 47, in the middle of it, what are we doing? Or what are we going to do? This man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. We talked about that last week. That was their fear, that if all these crowds start following him, then the Romans are going to be nervous about it, and they're going to come and just kind of like wipe them all out and take away this. And so they're concerned for their power, so they come up with this plan, and now they're seeing it. So I want you to notice, and this is why I talked about the size of the crowds earlier, just the tension that would have been in the air. There's these pulsing, huge crowds just cramming into every corner of the city. They're crying out about Jesus. They're waving these palm branches. They're calling him the king. And now the Pharisees are saying, the whole world's going after him. What are we going to do? Their worst fears were coming true. Okay, so we get this entry, this humble yet triumphal entry of the king. And then we see, though, that the hour has come for self-sacrifice. And that's our next section here. We'll get more time there. They say in verse 19, the world has gone after him. And then verse 20, we see an illustration of that where it says, there were some Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. And they came to Philip saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Example of the world is now these Greeks. So not merely the Jewish people that had crammed into the city for the Passover, but some Greeks, meaning Gentiles, meaning they weren't Jews, and yet they'd heard about Christ. And they were there for the feast. They'd be what we'd consider God-fearing Greeks. They believed in the true God of Israel. They were there for the feast, and they want to see Jesus. And so they come to one of the disciples. He confers with another because they're not quite so sure about this. And then they bring this request to Jesus that these Greeks want to see you. And he answers. But as often is the case when we're reading through the Gospels, his answer does not at first maybe appear to us to be directly about what the request was. The request is, there's these Greeks who want to see you. They want to talk to you. And Jesus doesn't just say, yes, bring them in, or no. He says something kind of much more loaded than that. Look at what he says. And so you can put your eyes on verse 23. Jesus answered them. So they say, hey, there's these Greeks who want to see you. This is Jesus' response. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And then he goes on to talk about him like being like a grain of wheat that's going to fall to the ground and die. He points to his coming death. He points to his coming death on the cross, that he'll be glorified in this. Why? How does he go from the Greeks want to see you to the hour has come? I think it has to do with, what does he mean when he says the Son of Man is going to be glorified? What does he mean when he says the hour has come? Because up to this point in John, the hour has not come. And over again it says that. So if you've been with us these many months, we've been going through John, we've encountered this several times already where Jesus says, the hour has not yet come. In John chapter 2, when his mom wants him to do something about this need at this feast, and he ends up turning water to wine, but he says first, the hour has not yet come. In John 4, with the woman at the well, he says, the hour has not yet come. It's going to come later, but the hour has not yet come. In John 7 and John 8, when people try to kill him, and he evades because it says the hour had not yet come. So it's been like this kind of rhythm throughout, looking ahead, until now he says the hour has come. The time has come. And from here on out in John, that will be the language. In chapter 13, verse 1, it will say as he is gathering with his disciples and he loved them to the end, he says the hour had come that he would depart out of this world. In John 17, when he's praying before he's arrested, says the hour has come. So this is a definitive turning point where now he's saying the hour has come, and it's come for the Son of Man, which is his way of talking about himself most often. It's a fulfillment of the language of Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14, it's a prophetic passage that describes how this figure, like the Son of Man, who's this divine messianic figure, will come and will gather the nations to himself. And it says this is him now. He is the Son of Man, who's going to be glorified. It's going to gather the nations, the Greeks as well as the Jews. As he's lifted up, he'll say here in just a little bit, he will draw all people to himself, meaning Jews and Gentiles both. He's going to be glorified. And this is how his glory is going to be seen. It's not like Bokassa the First, where his glory was seen on this big gold throne and this big parade of people and the multi-million dollar robe. No, his glory is going to be seen through his death, through his sacrifice, through his humility, through him giving himself for the people that he's saving. So they want to see him. But he turns to talk about what's coming up. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. So how is he going to be glorified? Look how he goes on to develop that. So that's verse 23. Time for the Son of Man to be glorified. In what way will he be glorified? Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, or it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. The hour has come for him to be glorified because the hour has come for his death. Remember, we're in the final week before he goes to the cross. And he compares it to like a grain of wheat needing to fall into the ground, meaning to be planted, seemingly dead, in order to bear fruit. We can understand this a little bit, the metaphor he's using. It's roughly time for spring planting here in Idaho, although always a little risky in April, right? There's maybe some of you that started planting your gardens. Anybody start planting a garden yet? Not many hands, because if you did, it probably froze, right? So probably more May, you know, if you're going to do that. But if you've done that before, you know the experience of you get a little seed bag and you dump out the seeds and they seem small, they seem lifeless, and they're thrown into the ground, they're planted and covered. And yet what comes from that is life. And it bears fruit. From one seed comes all these many seeds. And so Jesus uses that metaphor to describe what will happen to him, what in fact must happen to him. He says, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth, it dies, and dies it remains alone, but if it dies, it bears much fruit. Throughout this section, he's going to be talking about his coming death, how he'll be lifted up on a cross. And he says this is necessary to bear much fruit. What is that fruit? That fruit, beloved, if you're a believer, is you. That fruit that would be born through his death is those that he would save and would come to life through him. So he would give his life for your sins in your place. So if you trust in him, you are given life. You are given forgiveness. And so he's giving his life to save. And so he describes it like a seed going in the ground and bearing much fruit. This is his glory. This is the kind of king that he is. He's a king who comes to give his life. He's a sacrificial king. And then in a similar but not identical way, he then talks to his disciples, in a sense, talking down through history to us. Because he describes that for himself, being like a grain of wheat that falls into the earth and bears fruit. And then verse 25, it says, he who loves his life loses it. And he who hates his life in this world will keep it to life eternal. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. So he describes himself. And then there's immediately this teaching for us. And he says this somewhat cryptic statement. He who loves his life loses it. He who hates his life in this world will keep it to life eternal. What does he mean? What does he mean? What does it mean to love your life and therefore lose it, rather than hating your life and therefore gain this life eternal? I think what's confusing there is we use that phrase in different ways. Like there's a sense in which I would say, I love my life. I love where we live in Southeast Idaho, even with like the freezes that come in a little bit late, right? I love living here. I love being close to the mountains and the rivers. I love my family. I love spending time with them. I feel privileged to have this family. I love my job. I'm satisfied with it. I love this church body and I love being with you. I love walking through our backyard and watching spring growth pop up. There's I love my life. Is that what he's saying? No, you ought not to love life. You ought to hate all of that, right? You ought to not enjoy where you are. I don't think that's what's meant here. Rather, what I described is more of like enjoying the goodness of God. I mean, grateful for the goodness of God on display in these very tangible things in life. No, I think to understand what he means when he says, contrasts loving your life and losing it versus hating your life and keeping it, I think the very next verse helps. And then I think some comparative passages help. Because he goes on to say, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. And so I think whatever it is to hate your life, it is connected with serving him and following him. Keep in mind, he's just said that he's going to his death. And so to follow him, to go where he is to be willing to lay your life down. Consider the way he uses similar phrases in some other teachings. This is a common refrain in several different contexts. He uses very similar language. And as we look at those, I think it can help us get a better sense of what it means to love your life versus hate your life in the way he's using it here. This is Matthew. Matthew 10, starting in verse 37. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it. He who has lost his life for my sake will find it. You see in verse 39 some very similar language, not identical, but very similar. He who has found his life will lose it. He who has lost his life for my sake will find it. But consider how it fits in with what he says here. He who loves his father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. We're commanded to love our father and mother. We're commanded to love our family. But there ought to be a superior love for Christ. And when we place family above Christ, so that what becomes most important to me is not, will this please Jesus, but will it please my family, then that means I'm placing them in a spot where Christ ought to be on the throne. And he says, no, a disciple needs to be most concerned with what would please Christ. He does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. To take the cross is to go to your death. He's going to pick up his cross and go to his death. And so a disciple is called to take his cross and follow after me. We might wonder, what does that mean in a literal sense? There's some places in the world they read that and they're like, I know just what this means. You think of our brothers and sisters in like some parts of Nigeria, not all of Nigeria, but especially in the northern part, where there's ongoing brutal persecution of Christians. And yet the Christians still gather. And you can imagine them gathering and reading this passage and saying, okay, for me to be a Christian, it might mean my death, literally, at the hands of like Boko Haram. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to follow Christ? Knowing I might lose my life, but I gain eternal life. And the disciple is one who says, yeah, it's worth it. Jesus is worth it. In our context, where that's unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely, we start to ask, what does that mean to take up our cross? What does it mean to hold our life loosely? Let's keep kind of thinking on that question. Mark chapter 8, verse 35 and 36, he gets at similar things. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? He adds in here this phrase of, for my sake and for the gospel's sake. So holding our life loosely, saying what's most important is the gospel. It's the spread of the gospel. That's what Jesus gives his life for, and I want to hold my life loosely for that. I'm not going to try to just preserve my life. I'm willing to give my life for the sake of the gospel. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? I might gather the whole world. I might gather all this wealth, but if I don't have Christ, then it's not a good bargain. In the end, when I do die, I will have lost everything. It's not a good bargain if I gain the whole world and forfeit my soul. So what I think Jesus is calling us as disciples to in all these passages is simply to follow him. And what he's doing is sacrificially giving his life to save. And it's saying a disciple then should hold our life loosely. And in some contexts, that's meant literally people have given their lives. But I do think it means that the approval of Christ should be greater than all these other things. John Piper, he has a good quote on this where he says, he who hates his life in this world, as a way to help us understand in this world, hating your life in this world means that you will choose to do things that look foolish to the world. You will deny yourself things. You will take risks, embrace the path of suffering for the sake of love. This, Jesus says, will lead to eternal life and not death. So he contrasts that in this world. Am I living for just this world? Or do I say, no, I want to take delight in the things God has given me in this world, but I'm not living for it. I'm living for Christ. I think another way to help understand this is Jesus' words when he talks about true greatness. This is in Mark chapter 10, verses 43 and 44. It says, but it is not this way among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. To be a servant, to be a slave of all. That's where greatness is found. That's what a disciple is called to do, not place themselves first, but to serve. And then he gives the reason and the motivation by pointing to himself. He says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So he's not calling us to do something that he is unwilling to do himself. In fact, rather, he's pointing to his own example and saying, this is the kind of king I am, so our lives should mirror that. Well, what does that look like, though, in just practical ways? Because I think this is where we sometimes still struggle with. We think, okay, yeah, if there was an opportunity, like where my life was on the line and I was either deny Christ or you'd be killed, it's okay, yeah, I'm willing to die for Christ there. But what does that mean in just everyday life? I think we can reason from the greater to the lesser. That if that's what we're called to do in the greater sense, in the lesser sense, will I prioritize myself over Christ and over serving other people? Or will I say, no, I want to serve Christ even if it costs me in this moment? Will I choose to forgive somebody even though it's costly and it hurts and I don't want to? But that's what Christ calls me to do. And that's what he's done. He's forgiven me. When a tired parent comes home at the end of the day and they just want to rest, and yet they know there's more work to be done to like love and care for those kids that are there. So dad comes home, dad's been working all day, but he comes in the door and the kids just swarm him, right? I remember what it was like to have little kids and to come in the door. And on one hand, it was like being like a rock star, you know? They just swarm, you know? They're excited to see you. Have little kids, you sit on the floor, and it automatically means they jump on you. That's like a constant wrestling match. And as a parent, sometimes you could think, man, I'm tired. I don't feel like engaging right now. I just want to withdraw. And yet, to be a servant of all is to say, but what does Christ call me to do in this moment? He calls me to love and to pour myself out for the people he's entrusted to my care and this family. And so I'm going to be a servant in this moment and not just prioritize myself. There are countless daily ways that we can do that. And I think that would be within this command to say, if this is the king that we serve, a humble, gentle king who gave himself, then we should be willing in just a daily way to give ourselves. And honestly, sometimes that feels harder. You can think of like a comparison to marriage where a husband will often say, I would die for my wife. And yet I've been married now for 20 some years and like I haven't had an opportunity yet. There's like nobody's come to the door that I've had to like put myself in front of a bullet. Which, I mean, I'm glad like that hasn't happened. But so guys will say, I will die for my wife, but will you like care for her in a sacrificial way daily? Will you love her and prioritize her and serve and care for her? It's easier to say in theory I would give my life than it is in practice to just everyday ways be a servant. And yet that's the king that we serve. Then he calls us to follow that example. Notice just a few more things here before we wrap up. As Jesus anticipates this, he's troubled. He's talking very bluntly about his coming death. But in verse 27, he says, now my soul has become troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I came to this hour. So that phrase again is there, this hour. He's troubled as he anticipates it, as he considers his impending death. But he says, that I came for this purpose. And so he says, Father, glorify your name. We see that this was not easy, even as he anticipates that. We see it in this passage. He's troubled. We see it in Mark chapter 14, as just before his arrest and trial and crucifixion, he's in the garden praying. And just notice this language that's used. Took with him Peter and James and John and began to be very distressed and troubled. And he said to them, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch. He goes on. He went a little beyond them and he fell to the ground and began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass by him. That's that same phrase again, the hour. He was saying, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. If we picture him just talking about his coming death in just like a mechanical, just rote way, we're missing it. He's troubled. He becomes distressed, and yet he's willing. And he's committed to the Father's will. So here in John, he's troubled. The Father's voice comes audibly. Verse 28, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. That the glory is seen again in the sacrificial death of the Son. And he says, I will glorify it again. The crowd hears this. This is now the third time in the Gospels where this voice of the Father speaks audibly. At Jesus' baptism in Matthew 3, at the Transfiguration in Matthew 17, and then now here. And each time, it's this audible confirmation of who he is. He describes again, more specifically, what to expect. Verse 32, if I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. Jews and Greeks, the Greeks that were just coming to him, says he will draw to himself. Verse 33 does tell us this was to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. It's the cross. He'll be lifted up. They're confused because they say, no, the Messiah is going to remain forever. They're not realizing that the Messiah must first die and then will later came to reign on the earth. They're confused, which was often the case. And yet he is continuing to point to his coming death. Okay, let's pause here. I want you to consider a couple things, though. The application we've sort of seen running all along, but I want to narrow in on it a little bit. And I want to do it in the form of a question. What should your life look like if you follow the humble servant king? If this is who Jesus is, he is a king who comes humbly. He comes riding on a donkey, gentle. He describes his own glory as his coming death, and it's his death on behalf of people. As Mark would say, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And Jesus says, if you serve me, you will follow me. What should that look like in your life? I think too often what our lives look like, and speaking of myself as well, is that on the throne of my life is my own desires, my own pleasures, my own wants, my own good, rather than saying, no, what sits on the throne is Christ. And I want to serve him. And what that means is serving others. And so I want to pour out my life for others because that's what Christ did. So what does that look like? And does your life reflect that? And then second, and related, how can you live for Christ and die to self in everyday life this week? In everyday life this week, what are some ways that rather than seeking your own desires, your own will, your own self-protection, you can say, no, what's most important to me is Christ and the people he's given me to serve right now. How can I, as an act of worship, say Christ is better than just seeking my own pleasure? And I'm gonna not act selfishly. I'm gonna prioritize the good of others. Does that look like costly forgiveness? Does that look like maybe an opportunity? Maybe you're a college student. Maybe your friends are going out drinking, and you're like, if I go, there'll be some aspects that are going to be fun, but I know there's going to be a temptation towards sin in all these ways. I know how this is going to unfold, but if I don't do it, they're going to like make fun of me, or I'm going to miss out on something, Or are you going to say, like, no, I want to please Christ. And even if it means a Friday night alone, I want to please Christ. I'm going to say no to this. That would be dying to self in just an everyday way. So I want to prioritize pleasing Christ. And look what he did for me. And if he did that for me, I can say no to this, and I can follow him right now. I want you to consider, what are some everyday ways that you can follow him this week?